Chapter 3, The Dragon Council.
From the window of her room in the palace, Tanar had watched the ship sail, carrying Labannon and her daughter away into the night. She had not gone down to the wharf with Tahanu. It had been hard, very hard, to refuse to come with her on this journey. Tahanu had begged. She, who had never asked for anything. She never cried, could not cry, but her breath had caught, sobbing. "But I can't go. I can't go alone. Come with me, Mother." "My love, my heart. If I could spare you this fear, I would. Don't you see? I can't. I've done what I could do for you. My flame of fire, my star. The king is right. Only you, you alone, can do this."
"But if you were just there, so I knew you were there."
"I'm here. I'm always here. What could I do there but be a burden? You must travel fast. It will be a hard journey. I'd hold you back. And you might fear for me. You don't need me. I'm no use to you. You must learn that. You must go, Tahanu." And she had turned away from her child and began sorting out the clothing Tahanu should take. Home clothes. Not the fancy things they wore here in the palace. Her stout shoes, her good cloak. If Tanar wept while she did it, she did not let her daughter see it. Tahanu stood as if bewildered, paralyzed with fear. When Tanar gave her clothes to change into, she obeyed. When the king's lieutenant, Yanai, knocked and asked if he might conduct Mistress Tahanu down to the wharf, she stared at him like a dumb animal. "Go now," Tanar said. She embraced her and laid her hand on the great scar that was half her face. "You are Kalesan's daughter as well as mine." The girl held her very tightly for a long moment, let go, turned away without a word, and followed Yanai out the door. Tanar stood feeling the chill of the night air with the heat of Tahanu's body and arms had been. She went over to the window, lights down on the dock, the coming and going of men, the hoof clatter of horses being led down the steep streets above the water. A tall ship was at the pier, a ship she knew, the Dolphin. She watched from the window and saw Tahanu on the dock. She saw her go aboard at last, leading a horse that had been balking, and saw Labannon follow her. She saw the mooring lines cast off, the docile movement of the ship following the oared tug that towed her clear. The sudden fall and flowering of the white sails in the darkness. The light of the stern lantern trembled on the dark water, shrank slowly to a tiny drop of brightness, and was gone. Tanar went about the room, folding up the clothes Tahanu had worn. The silken shift and overskirt. She picked up the light sandals and held them to her cheek a while before she put them away. She lay awake in the wide bed and saw before her mind's eye over and over again the same scene. A road, and Tahanu walking on it alone. And a knot, a net, a black, writhing, coiling mass descending from the sky, dragons swarming, fire licking and streaming from them at her, her hair burning, her clothes burning. "No," Tanar said, "no, it will not happen." She would force her mind away from that scene until she saw it again, the road, and Tahanu walking on it alone, and the black, burning knot in the sky coming closer. When the first light began to turn the room gray, she slept at last, exhausted. She dreamed that she was in the old mage's house on the Overfell, her house, and she was glad beyond all words to be there. She took the broom from behind the door to sweep the shining oaken floor, for Ged had let it get dusty. But there was a door at the back of the house that had not been there before. When she opened it, she found a small, low room with stone walls painted white. Ged was crouching in the room, squatting with his arms on his knees and his hands hanging limp. His head was not a man's head, but small, black, and beaked, a vulture's head. He said in a faint, hoarse voice, "Tanar, I have no wings." And when he said that, such anger and terror rose up in her that she woke, gasping, to see sunlight on the high wall of her palace room and hear the sweet, clear trumpets telling the fourth hour of morning. Breakfast was brought. She ate a little and talked with Barry, the elderly servant whom she had chosen from all the retinue of maids and ladies of honor Labannon had offered her. Barry was an intelligent, competent woman, born in a village in inland Havnor, with whom Tanar got on better than with most of the ladies of the court. They were civil and respectful, but they didn't know what to do with her, how to talk to a woman who was half Kargish priestess, half farmwife from Gaunt. She saw that it was easier for them to be kind to Tehanu in her fierce timidity. They could be sorry for her. They could not be sorry for Tanar. Barry, however, could be and was, and she gave Tanar considerable comfort that morning. "The king will bring her back safe and sound," she said. "Why do you think he'd take the girl into a danger he couldn't get her out of? Never! Not him!" It was false comfort, but Barry so passionately believed it to be true that Tanar had to agree with her, which was a little solace in itself. She needed something to do, for Tehanu's absence was everywhere. She resolved to go talk to the Kargish princess to see if the girl was willing to learn a word of Hardik, or at least to tell Tanar her name. In the Kargad lands, people did not have a true name that they kept secret, as the speakers of Hardik did. Like use names here, Kargish names often had some meaning. Rose, Alder, Honor, Hope. Or they were traditional, often the name of an ancestor. People spoke them openly and were proud of the antiquity of a name passed down from generation to generation. She had been taken too young from her parents to know why they had called her Tanar, but thought it might be for a grandmother or great-grandmother. That name had been taken from her when she was recognized as Arha, the Nameless One Reborn, and she had forgotten it till Ged gave it back to her. To her, as to him, it was her true name. But it was not a word of the old speech. It gave no one any power over her, and she had never concealed it. She was puzzled now why the princess did so. Her bondwomen called her only princess, or lady, or mistress. The ambassadors had talked about her as the High Princess, daughter of Thol, lady of Hur Ator, and so on. If all the poor girl had was titles, it was time she had a name. Tanar knew it was not fitting for a guest of the king to go alone through the streets of Havnor, and she knew Barry had duties in the palace, so she asked for a servant to accompany her. She was provided with a charming footman, or footboy, for he was only about 15, who looked after her at the street crossings as if she were a doddering crone. She liked walking in the city. She had already found and admitted to herself, going to the river house, that it was easier without Tehanu beside her. People would look at Tehanu and look away, and Tehanu walked in stiff, suffering pride, hating their looks and their looking away. And Tanar suffered with her, maybe more than she herself did. Now she was able to loiter and watch the street shows, the market booths, the various faces and clothing from all over the archipelago. To go out of the direct way, to let her footboy show her a street where the painted bridges from rooftop to rooftop made a kind of airy, vaulted ceiling high above them, from which red flowering vines looped down in festoons, and people put bird cages out the windows on gilt poles among the flowers, so that it all seemed a garden in the middle of the air. Oh, I wish Tehanu could see this, she thought. But she could not think of Tehanu, of where she might be. The river house, like the new palace, dated from the reign of Queen Heru, 5 centuries ago. It had been in ruins when Labanan came to the throne. He had rebuilt it with much care, and it was a lovely, peaceful place, sparsely furnished with dark, polished, uncarpeted floors. Ranks of narrow door windows slid aside to open up the whole side of a room to a view of the willows and the river, and one could walk out onto deep wooden balconies built over the water. Court ladies had told Tanar that it had been the place the king liked best to slip away to for a night of solitude, or a night with a lover, which lent even more significance, they hinted, to his housing the princess there. Her own suspicion was that he had not wanted the princess under the same roof with him and had simply named the only other possible place for her, but maybe the court ladies were right. Guards in their fine harness recognized and let her pass. Footmen announced her and went off with her footboy to crack nuts and gossip, which seemed to be the principal occupation of footmen, and ladies-in-waiting came to greet her, grateful for any new face and gasping for more news of the king's expedition against the dragons. Having run the whole gamut, she was admitted at last to the apartments of the princess. On her 2 previous visits, she had been kept waiting some while in an anteroom, and then the veiled bondwomen had brought her into an inner room, the only dim room in the whole airy house, where the princess had stood in her round-brimmed hat, with the red veil hanging down all around it to the floor, looking permanently fixed there, built in, exactly as if she were a brick chimney, as Lady Iyesa had said. This time it was different. As soon as she came into the anteroom, there was shrieking within and the sound of people running in various directions. The princess burst through the door and with a wild cry flung her arms around Tanar. Tanar was small, and the princess, a tall, vigorous young woman full of emotion, knocked her right off her feet, but held her up in strong arms. "Oh, Lady Arha! Lady Arha! Save me! Save me!" she was crying. Princess, what's wrong? The princess was in tears of terror or relief or both at once, and Altenar could understand if her laments and pleas was a babble of dragons and sacrifice. There are no dragons near Havnor, she said sternly, disengaging herself from the girl, and nobody is being sacrificed. What is this all about? What have you been told?
The women said the dragons were coming, and they'd sacrifice a king's daughter and not a goat because they're sorcerers, and I was afraid.
The princess wiped her face, clenched her hands, and began trying to master the panic she had been in. It had been real, ungovernable terror, and Tanar was sorry for her. She did not let her pity show. The girl needed to learn to hold on to her dignity. Your women are ignorant and don't know enough about Hardik to understand what people tell them. And you don't know any Hardik at all. If you did, you'd know there's nothing to be afraid of. Do you see the people of the house here rushing about weeping and screaming? The princess stared at her. She wore no hat, no veils, and only a light shift dress, for it was a hot day. It was the first time Tanar had seen her except as a dim form through the red veiling. Though the princess's eyes were swollen with tears and her face blotched, she was magnificent. Tawny-haired, tawny-eyed, with round arms and full breasts and slender waist, a woman in her first full beauty and strength.
But none of those people is going to be sacrificed, she said finally.
Nobody is going to be sacrificed.
Then why are the dragons coming?
Tanar drew a deep breath. Princess, he said, there are a great many things we need to talk about. If you'll look at me as your friend,
I do, the princess said.
She stepped forward and took Tanar's right arm in a very strong grasp.
You are my friend. I have no other friend. I will shed my blood for you.
Ridiculous as it was, Tanar knew it was true. She returned the girl's grip as well as she could and said, You are my friend. Tell me your name. The princess's eyes got big. There was a little snot and blubber still on her upper lip. Her lower lip trembled. She said, with a deep breath,
Seserach.
Seserach, my name is not Arha, but Tanar.
Tanar, the girl said, and grasped her arm tighter.
Now, Tanar said, trying to regain control of the situation, I have walked a long way and I'm thirsty. Please let's sit down, and may I have some water to drink, and then we can talk.
Yes,
said the princess, and leapt out of the room like a hunting lioness. There were shouts and cries from the inner rooms and more sounds of running. A bondwoman appeared, adjusting her veil shakily and gibbering something in such thick dialect Tanar could not understand her.
Speak in the accursed tongue,
shouted the princess from within, and the woman pitifully squeaked out in Hardik.
To sit? To drink? Lady?
Two chairs had been set in the middle of the dark, stuffy room, facing each other. Seserach stood beside one of them. I should like to sit outside in the shade over the water, Tanar said, if it please you, princess. The princess shouted, the women scuttled, the chairs were carried out onto the deep balcony. They sat down side by side. That's better, Tanar said. It was still strange to her to be speaking Kargish. She had no difficulty with it at all, but she felt as if she were not herself, were somebody else speaking, an actor enjoying her role.
You like the water? The princess asked.
Her face had returned to its normal color, that of heavy cream, and her eyes, no longer swollen, were bluish gold, or blue with gold flecks. Yes, you don't?
I hate it. There was no water where I lived.
A desert? I lived in a desert, too, until I was 16. Then I crossed the sea and came west. I love the water, the sea, the rivers.
Oh, the sea, Seserach said,
shrinking and putting her head in her hands.
Oh, I hate it. I hate it. I vomited my soul out, over and over and over, days and days and days. I never want to see the sea again.
She shot a quick glance through the willow boughs at the quiet, shallow stream below them.
This river is all right, she said distrustfully.
A woman brought a tray with a pitcher and cups, and Tanar had a long drink of cool water. Princess, she said, we have a great deal to talk about. First, the dragons are still a long way away in the west. The king and my daughter have gone to talk with them.
To talk with them?
Yes. She had been going to say more, but she said, Now, please, tell me about the dragons in Hur-At-Hur. Tanar had been told as a child in Atwan that there were dragons in Hur-At-Hur, dragons in the mountains, brigands in the desert. Hur-At-Hur was poor and far away, and nothing good came from it, but opals and turquoises and cedar logs. Sesarach heaved a deep sigh. Tears came into her eyes. It makes me cry to think about home, she said, with such pure simplicity of feeling that tears came into Tinar's eyes, too. Well, the dragons live up in the mountains, 2 days, 3 days' journey from Mesrith. It's all rocks up there, and nobody bothers the dragons, and they don't bother anybody. But once a year they come down, crawling down a certain way. It's a path, all smooth dust, made by their bellies crawling along it every year since time began. It's called the Dragon's Way. She saw that Tinar was listening with deep attention and went on. It's taboo to cross the Dragon's Way. You mustn't set foot on it at all. You have to go clear around it, south of the place of the sacrifice. They start crawling down it late in spring. On the fourth day of the fifth month, they've all arrived at the place of the sacrifice. None of them is ever late, and everybody from Mesrith and the villages is there waiting for them. And then, when they've all come down the Dragon's Way, the priests begin the sacrifice. And that's... Don't you have the spring sacrifice in Atuan? Tinar shook her head. Well, that's why I got scared, you see, because it can be a human sacrifice. If things weren't going well, they'd sacrifice a king's daughter. Otherwise, it would be just some ordinary girl. But they haven't done even that for a long time. Not since I was little. Since my father defeated all the other kings. Since then, they've only sacrificed a she-goat and a ewe, and they catch the blood in bowls and throw the fat into the sacred fire and call to the dragons. And the dragons all come crawling up. They drink the blood and eat the fire. She shut her eyes for a moment, so did Tinar. Then they go back up into the mountains, and we go back to Mesrith. How big are the dragons? Sesarach put her hands about a yard apart. Sometimes bigger, she said. And they can't fly or speak? Oh, no. Their wings are just little stubs. They make a kind of hissing. Animals can't talk. But they're sacred animals. They're the sign of life, because fire is life. And they eat fire and spit out fire. And they're sacred because they come to the spring sacrifice. Even if no people came, the dragons would come and gather at that place. We come there because the dragons do. The priests always tell all about that before the sacrifice. Tinar absorbed this for a while. The dragons here in the west, she said, are large, huge, and they can fly. They're animals, but they can speak, and they are sacred and dangerous. Well, the princess said, dragons may be animals, but they're more like us than the accursed sorcerers are. She said accursed sorcerers all as one word and without any particular emphasis. Tinar remembered that phrase from her childhood. It meant the dark folk, the Hardic people of the archipelago. Why is that? Because the dragons are reborn, like all the animals, like us. Sesarach looked at Tinar with frank curiosity. I thought since you were a priestess at the most sacred place of the tombs, you'd know a lot more about all that than I do. But we had no dragons there, Tinar said. I didn't learn anything about them at all. Please, my friend, tell me. Well, let me see if I can tell the story about it. It's a winter story. I guess it's all right to tell it in summer here. Everything here is all wrong anyway. She sighed. Well, in the beginning, you know, in the first time, we were all the same, all the people and the animals. We did the same things. And then we learned how to die. And so we learned how to be reborn, maybe as one kind of being, maybe another. But it doesn't matter so much because anyhow you'll die again and get reborn again and get to be everything sooner or later. Tinar nodded. So far the story was familiar to her. But the best things to get reborn as are people and dragons, because those are the sacred beings. So you try not to break the taboos, and you try to observe the precepts, so you have a better chance to be a person again, or anyhow a dragon. If dragons here can talk and are so big, I can see why that would be a reward. Being one of ours never seemed like much to look forward to. But the story is about the accursed sorcerers discovering the Vedernon. That was a thing, I don't know what it was, that told some people that if they'd agree never to die and never be reborn, they could learn how to do sorcery. So they chose that. They chose the Vedernon. And they went off into the west with it, and it turned them dark. And they live here, all these people here. They're the ones who chose the Veternon. They live, and they can do their accursed sorceries, but they can't die. Only their bodies die. The rest of them stays in a dark place and never gets reborn, and they look like birds. But they can't fly.
Yeah,
Tanar whispered. You didn't learn about that on Atuan?
No, Tanar said.
Her mind was recalling the story the women of Kamai told Ogion. In the beginning of time, mankind and the dragons had been one. But the dragons chose wildness and freedom, and mankind chose wealth and power. A choice. A separation.
Was it the same story?
But the image in Tanar's heart was of Ged squatting in a stone room, his head small, black, beaked. The Veternon isn't that ring, is it? That they kept talking about that I'm going to have to wear?
Tanar tried to force her mind away from the painted room and from last night's dream to Sesarok's question.
Ring? Erthakby's ring.
Erithakby, no. That ring is the Ring of Peace, and you'll wear it only if and when you're King Libanon's queen. And you'll be a lucky woman to be that.
Sesarok's expression was curious. It was not sullen or cynical. It was hopeless. Half-humorous, patient. The expression of a woman decades older.
There is no luck about it, dear friend Tanar, she said.
I have to marry him, and so I will be lost.
Why are you lost if you marry him?
If I marry him, I have to give him my name. If he speaks my name, he steals my soul. That's what the accursed sorcerers do. So they always hide their names. But if he steals my soul, I won't be able to die. I'll have to live forever without my body, a bird that can't fly and never be reborn.
That's why you hid your name.
I gave it to you, my friend.
I honor the gift, my friend, Tanar said energetically, but you can say your name to anybody you want here. They can't steal your soul with it, believe me, Sesarok, and you can trust him. He won't do you any harm.
The girl had caught her hesitation. But he wishes he could, she said. Tanar, my friend, I know what I am here. In that big city, Awabath, where my father is, I was a stupid, ignorant desert woman, a Fayagat. The city women sniggered and poked each other whenever they saw me. The barefaced whores. And here it's worse. I can't understand anybody, and they can't understand me. And everything is different. I don't even know what the food is. It's sorcerer food. It makes me dizzy. I don't know what the taboos are. There aren't any priests to ask. Only sorcerer women, all black and barefaced. And I saw the way he looked at me. You can see out of the Fayag, you know. I saw his face. He's very handsome. He looks like a warrior. But he's a black sorcerer and he hates me. Don't say he doesn't, because I know he does. And I think when he learns my name, he'll send my soul to that place forever. After a while gazing into the moving branches of the willows over the softly moving water, feeling sad and weary, Tanar said, What you need to do then, princess, is learn how to make him like you. What else can you do? Sesarok shrugged mournfully. It would help if you understood what he said. Bagaba, bagaba, they all sound like that.
And we sound like that to them. Come on, princess. How can he like you if all you can say to him is bagaba bagaba?
Look, and she held up her hand, pointed to it with the other, and said the word first in Kargish, then in Hardik.
Sesarok repeated both words in a dutiful tone. After a few more body parts, she suddenly grasped the potentialities of translation. She sat up straighter.
How do sorcerers say king?
Agni. It's a word of the old speech. My husband told me that. She realized as she spoke that it was foolish to bring up the existence of yet a third language at this point, but that was not what caught the princess's attention.
You have a husband?
Sesarok stared at her with luminous, leonine eyes and laughed aloud.
Oh, how wonderful! I thought you were a priestess. Oh, please, my friend, tell me about him. Is he a warrior? Is he handsome? Do you love him?
After the king went dragon hunting, Alder had no idea what to do. He felt utterly useless, unjustified in staying in the palace, eating the king's food, guilty for the trouble he had brought with him. He could not sit all day in his room, so he went out into the streets. But the splendor and activity of the city were daunting to him, and having no money or purpose, all he could do was walk till he was tired. He would come back to the palace of Meharian, wondering if the stern-faced guards would readmit him. The nearest he came to peace was in the palace gardens. He hoped to meet Rhodey there again, but the child did not appear, and perhaps that was as well. Alder thought that he should not talk with people. The hands that reached to him from death would reach out to them. On the third day after the king's departure, he went down to walk among the garden pools. The day had been very hot. The evening was still and sultry. He brought Tug with him and let the little cat loose to stalk insects under the bushes, while he sat on a bench near the big willow and watched the silver-green glimmer of fat carp in the water. He felt lonely and discouraged. He felt his defense against the voices and the reaching hands was breaking down. What was the good of being here after all? Why not go into the dream once and for all, go down that hill, be done with it? Nobody in the world would grieve for him, and his death would spare them this sickness he had brought with them. Surely they had enough to do fighting dragons. Maybe if he went there, he would see Lily. If he was dead, they could not touch each other. The wizards said they would not even want to. They said the dead forgot what it was to be alive. But Lily had reached to him. At first, for a little while, maybe they would remember life long enough to look at each other, to see each other, even if they did not touch. Alder. He looked up slowly at the woman who stood near him. The small gray woman, Tanar. He saw the concern in her face, but did not know why she was troubled. Then he remembered that her daughter, the burned girl, had gone with the king. Maybe there had been bad news. Maybe they were all dead. Are you ill, Alder? She asked. He shook his head. It was hard to talk. He understood now how easy it would be in that other land not to speak, not to meet people's eyes, not to be troubled. She sat down on the bench beside him. You look troubled, she said. He made a vague gesture. It's all right. It's no matter. You were on Gaunt with my husband, Sparrowhawk. How was he? Was he looking after himself? Yes, Alder said. He tried to answer more adequately. He was the kindest of hosts. I'm glad to hear that, she said. I worry about him. He keeps house as well as I do, but still I didn't like leaving him alone. Please, would you tell me what he was doing while you were there? He told her that Sparrowhawk had picked the plums and taken them to sell, that the two of them had mended the fence, that Sparrowhawk had helped him sleep. She listened intently, seriously, as if these small matters were as weighty as the strange events they had talked about here 3 days ago. The dead calling to a living man, a girl becoming a dragon, dragons setting fire to the islands of the west. Indeed, he did not know what weighed more heavily after all, the great strange things or the small common ones. I wish I could go home, the woman said. I could wish the same thing, but it would be in vain. I think I'll never go home again. He did not know why he said it, but heard himself say it and thought it was true. She looked at him a minute with her quiet gray eyes and asked no question. I could wish my daughter would go home with me, she said, but it would be in vain too. I know she must go on. I don't know where. Will you tell me what gift it is that she has? What woman she is that the king sent for her and took her with him to meet the dragons? Oh, if I knew what she is, I'd tell you, Tanar said, her voice full of grief and love and bitterness. She's not my daughter born, as you may have guessed or known. She came to me a little child, saved from the fire, but only barely, and not wholly saved. When Sparrowhawk came back to me, she became his daughter too, and she kept both him and me from a cruel death by summoning a dragon, Kalesin, called Eldest, and that dragon called her daughter. So she's the child of many and none, spared no pain, yet spared from the fire. Who she is, in truth, I may never know. But I wish she were here now, safe with me. He wanted to reassure her, but his own heart was too low. Tell me a little more about your wife, Alder, she said. I cannot, he said at last, into the silence that lay easily between them. I would if I could, Lady Tanar. There's such a heaviness in me, and a dread and fear tonight. I try to think of Lily, but there's only that dark desert going down and down, and I can't see her in it. All the memories I had of her that were like water and breath to me have gone into that dry place. I have nothing left. I am sorry, she whispered, and they sat again in silence. The dusk was deepening. It was windless, very warm. Lights in the palace shone through the carved window screens and the still hanging foliage of the willows. Something is happening, Tanar said. A great change in the world. Maybe nothing we knew will be left to us. Alder looked up into the darkening sky. The towers of the palace stood clear against it, their pale marble and alabaster catching all the light left in the west. His eyes sought the sword blade mounted at the point of the highest tower, and he saw it, faint silver. Look, he said. At the sword's point, like a diamond or a drop of water, shone a star. As they watched, the star moved free of the sword, rising straight above it. There was a commotion, in the palace or outside the walls. Voices, a horn sounded, a sharp, imperative call. They've come back, Tanar said and stood up. Excitement had come into the air, and Alder too stood up. Tanar hurried into the palace from which the harbor could be seen. But before he took Tug back inside, Alder looked up again at the sword, now only a faint glimmer, and the star riding bright above it.